Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Brown Car Guy and Buddies. And today I'm going to be talking to another good friend of mine, Mitch Pereira. Mitchell, as he's known to his mum. Now, he's been in the UAE since the age of 10, and he's about the same age as me. So let's just say that's a very long time. So certainly he knows a lot about cars and the car culture and the car business there in the UAE. So it'll be interesting to talk to him about that. Mitch is somebody I know very much as a muscle car guy, very much a GM guy, somebody who loves off-roading. He was in the off-road tourism industry there for a while. He's somebody who just can't leave cars alone. He has to modify and customize everything. He's really big into that. He's somebody who's done SEMA like every year since forever. One thing I didn't realize about him, which I saw from some information that he sent me, is he actually spent 3 years here in the UK. So it'll be interesting to talk to him about that. But also bearing in mind all of his sort of car culture and his sort of car interest, it's interesting to learn that he's starting to embrace the new way of doing things. So this is going to be really, really interesting. Anyway, we're going to get into that in a moment. Make sure that you're subscribing to my YouTube channel. This is youtube.com/browncarguy. And of course, follow me on all social media. Just search for #browncarguy. You can see on my hat there, that's on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And of course, you can subscribe to browncarguy.com, which you can see there on the screen behind me. And let's get into this. Hey Mitch, long time no see. How you doing, buddy? It's been ages.
Hey Shazad, it feels like ages. I know you've been away for a while, and but you know, you're still not really away because we follow you religiously, so it's almost like you're here.
Thank you.
But yeah, it's going along, and you know, I don't know if you want to call it post-COVID blues or ongoing COVID blues, but
I think it's definitely ongoing COVID blues, but it's relaxed a little bit there now, hasn't it? Things are starting to get back to normal, aren't they?
Yeah, from that standpoint, yeah, people are coming out of, you know, the hiding, and, you know, people are starting to accept the fact that life has to go on, and things like that. In terms of relaxation, and then in terms of our part of the world and our demographics, we'll be even having a car meet this coming Friday, which is
a live car meet with people and everything.
It's kind of like a soft version of what we used to do back in the day. It's a swap meet,
arrive
and drive kind of thing.
We'll come on to that because we've got quite a bit of history with car meets, haven't we? I don't put much credence into these virtual car meets. I wasn't particularly impressed with that. I know people were trying to do something during lockdown, but that's not a car meet to me. Do you know what I mean?
No, not at all.
So I just you sent me your bio, which was really cool, and you have pretty much.
I hope it wasn't too crazy, because I kind of jotted down whatever I've been doing since.
Well, the thing that, because I got to know you probably pretty much soon after I got to Dubai, and I got to Dubai in 2006. But you've been in Dubai pretty much most of your life, apart from minus 10. And then 3 other years we're going to talk about in a minute. But so you're originally from Sri Lanka.
Correct.
And how did you end up in the UAE then?
Okay, so my dad came here to work. He came here with International Air Radio Limited, which was part of British Airways, which was at the time called BOAC, going back in time.
Yeah.
And they were... somehow instrumental in building the Sharjah International Airport.
Oh wow!
Back in the mid 70s. So he was one of the guys who came in, but at the time he was working for Lufthansa.
Oh right.
And Frankfurt Airport, or what they call the FAG, they brought in a few people from all over the world, or they asked people if they wanted to go to a different destination. And I think my dad was one of the crazy ones that put his hand up without knowing what exactly was his store.
So what did he exactly do?
Well, he's a line maintenance guy. So he's an aircraft engineer, mechanic, whatever you want to call it.
Interesting, interesting. So hang on. So I know you as quite a bit of a hands-on car guy as well. So this is quite interesting. Is this where this has come from? That whole car thing and the engine and, you know, into engineering and stuff like that.
I think that's passed down the line. I think through generations. My granddad was a huge car nut.
Oh really?
Back in the 50s in Sri Lanka.
What kind of car culture was there in Sri Lanka in the 50s? So paint a picture for us.
Well, it was very similar to the car culture in India at the time, because you know, you had the Maharajas and you had all those wealthy people bringing in numerous models of American cars. You know, obviously, like with today's trends and times, you know, I guess music played a big role, because, you know, you often saw the Elvis style caddies and, you know, so I kind of grew up with cars that existed in our household. So in fact, I was when I was born, apparently I was taken home in a 57 Bel Air Chevy.
Oh my god, that is like the coolest way to get home from the hospital. Wow.
Yeah, so that's what my parents say. And then you know, we had everything from Ford Custom Lines to DeSotos to
these are the
ones I can remember. And then we had caddies, and then we had a huge collection of British, Australian, what some would call it muscle cars in that time. So we had Ford Consuls, Ford
wow.
Zephyrs.
Holy
these
God.
Are all V8s.
Yeah.
And then we had cars. Obviously, we had a numerous amount of Capris and Anglias and, uh-huh. You know, that kind of car. My dad had once upon a time a Hillman.
Wow.
I kind of grew up with all that.
That's quite an eclectic mix of cars, but I can certainly see a V8 thread going through there, because I know you as a muscle car guy, and I can see where the origins of that were. There you go. I can see where the origins of that was laid.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm a big V8 guy, and I don't know how things are going to be going into the future with non-V8 and non-fuel, and but you know, it's one of those things we have to embrace, I guess.
I think we're going to end up a couple of dinosaurs very soon, but anyway, we'll keep living the dream while we can. So your dad ended up in Sharjah, so you went there about when you were 10 years old. So
I was 10, yes.
You've got the airport connection, you've got the car connection, because you've got quite a bit of tourism in your blood as well.
Okay, I right after high school, I was a bit of a lost kid, so I wanted to do something immediately. I wasn't really interested in studying further, and I don't know whether you want to call it fortunately or unfortunately, but my parents really didn't push me either. So I decided to, you know, I got my driver's license in the UAE in 1987. And right after that, literally a week after I got my license, we saw an ad in the paper from Orient Tours, which is based in Sharjah. And they were looking out for off-road drivers, stroke guides, to do the desert safari tours, as they call it these days.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it was very rustic. It was very simple.
What kind of cars were they?
Well, we drove inline six Land Cruiser 60 series. On a good day, six cylinders were working.
Yeah.
On most days, it was 4.5. So it was manual trans. So talk about baptism by fire. I mean, those were great.
So had you done desert driving before, or you just thought that's a good idea? I'll apply for this job and I'll just do it.
No, it was, well, I've been obviously been in the dunes numerous times with dad and his friends. So again, once we got to the UAE, when we didn't have the luxury of a 4x4, we even used to go and venture off in saloon cars. Obviously, paying the price, getting stuck, and, you know, buried to the floorboards and on our knees, digging with our hands kind of days.
Yeah.
But we had, back in the day, we had some, I think one of the most fondest memories I have is with the Lada Niva that we owned once upon a time.
Yeah.
And
those would have been quite rare there, though.
They were rare, but you know what? That thing was bulletproof. It went, you aim it, it went just about everywhere you can possibly go.
So this is the little 4x4 that Lada used to produce.
It's the 4x4.
And what year would this have been?
I would like to say 82. 82,
wow,
82.
As early as that. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it would have been really rare. Because I remember when I started out, journalism, I was in Saudi, and I remember the Lada brand being introduced around 1990 to the Saudi market for the first time. So for you to have one in 82, I wonder how that
it must. I don't know how my dad got hold of it. It was lying around in our workshop. So when my dad was working at the airport, we also had a little garage. I can't even call it a workshop, but we had a little garage in Ajman, where we tinkered around with cars. One of my very first vehicles that I could claim to own is a 1600 Daihatsu Jeep. You know, the one that you could actually roll down the front windshield?
Yes.
Yeah, I had one of those, but I had no four-wheel drive, so it was a two-wheel drive. but what we did was we did a Mitsubishi Galant 1800 cc engine swap in it.
Oh wow.
And we put really fat sticky tires at the back and I drove it like a dune buggy all over Fossil Rock or whatever, you know, so, people claim.
So is this your earliest customization then? Because I know you also as a big custom guy and, you know, modifying stuff, you know, is this where it started then?
I suppose, and you know, I'm pretty much known for driving anything non-stock. I've never owned a stock vehicle in my life. and when I did, that was in 2005. My wife and I bought a Lumina SS, brand new. I didn't even take it home without swapping the wheels and suspension.
I wouldn't expect anything less from you. But where do you think that came from? Is that just out of an interest in it? Or were you always into like reading hot rod magazines and custom magazines and stuff like that? Or
yeah. I mean, the initial days, you know, growing up. Okay, I was always into cars. I was never into, you know, football or cricket or basketball like most Asian kids are. If it had an engine, I would go along with it. It would, you know, there would be interest.
Yeah.
So as with many people in the car industry or motorsport, I started life with a skateboard. You know, it was skateboarding and then it's BMX bikes, jumping over things. And soon you know, migrate to four wheels as soon as you get your license. So that's kind of how the whole passion grew. But I always wanted to drive, passionately. That was one of my biggest passions, whether it was on road, off road, track, it didn't matter. So right after, and that's one of the main reasons why I jumped at the idea of the desert tour operation business, because here, you had an opportunity to drive 365 days a year off-road and get paid for it.
Yeah.
So when you're that young and, you know, you're out of high school, your brain functions in a different way. So I said, that's what I'm going to do.
And you're in the desert, so traffic rules don't necessarily apply. So any mishaps or misadventures during that time?
There's an add-on to the off-road driving. I was very much into geology in school. So for me, the great outdoors, the geographical terrain, you know, appeals to me very much. So I think it was a great combo. And to this day, I tend to do a lot of expedition style trails and drives. I don't belong to many groups, although people want me to join. I'm more of the long ranger type of person. I like to travel on my own.
That's it.
Because I just prefer the tranquility and the peace. And unfortunately, since the birth of GPS and electronic world, a lot of people go to the same old places. So, you know, the touristy places that we used to take our guests are now completely bombarded by the so-called off-roaders of today.
Yeah.
So, you know, your fossil rocks, your camel rocks, your Faiha dunes, your Swaihans, those are the areas I keep away from.
No, it's pretty crazy. No, I'll tell you what, it's one of the things that I miss about being over there, actually, is, I mean, I don't do that much off-roading, as you know, but I do like going out and doing and shooting cars in the desert, and it's always amazing. You can always find a quiet road somewhere, a completely secluded spot, and, you know, little tracks and stuff that you can get, even not in, not in an off-roader, you know. So, yeah, it's because over here in the UK, you can never find anywhere as isolated as that.
I'll tell you what, I'm talking of the UK, I mean... you mentioned the 3 years.
So this is the thing. You were here 3 years when you started, when you first started working for GM, I think. That was when...
Correct.
So how come you started working for GM in the UAE, but how did you end up here for 3 years then?
Okay, so that was a program that GM ran at the time. They wanted me to learn what they were doing in the UK and then mirror that here in the Middle East. So it's kind of like a train the trainer type of deal. That's kind of how, so I was employed out of the Trade Center office here and then, you know, moved over to the UK with the Vauxhall Off-Road Club. And we did a lot of performance driving there with the UK pro drivers as well. And, you know, it was great. It was a great, because the way I figured was I had, by that time, I had acquired enough of off-road driver experience in the sand and the gravel and the rock, but I wanted to have a go at mud and snow, which I didn't have under my belt. So
how did you find that? How did you find, because, you know, personally speaking, I'm not an enthusiastic dune driver, but I enjoy it. I do enjoy doing, you know, wadis and stuff like that. I do enjoy doing trails, but I do not enjoy doing mud. I can tell you that much.
Yeah. Okay. So basically off-road driving, I think it just sort of breaks into two segments. You have the performance stuff, which is the high speed stuff, which kind of, you know, is done on sand. And then you have the tactical stuff.
Yeah.
Now the tactical stuff is snow, mud, gravel, you know, rock crawl, etc. It's not for everybody, you know. And then you've got to have a lot of skill on driver's side, but at the same time, your rigs or your vehicles have to be set up to do just that.
Yeah.
So you can't take a bog standard showroom car and you know head on into some muddy pit and hope like hell that it comes out the other side. So, you know, such as mud terrain tires, for example, they don't come out of the showroom with mud terrain tires. So there are certain elements that you need to change. But my, coming back to the UK part, there's so much beauty out there. If you're up in the Peak District, Lake District, there's a lot of cool trails that you can actually traverse. And you can really have a great day out off-roading. But it's very slow. It's all low box, low ratio gear, first gear mostly, diesel vehicles. So you don't have that real adrenaline rush as such, like when you're driving in the sand dunes.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the UK, and it's quite weird that we haven't spoken about it. And all the time that I knew you, we didn't really talk about it much, that you spent 3 years over here. Because for some reason, I've always associated you more with America, because I know you spend a lot of time, you go over for SEMA every year, you spend a lot of time out there. You have a real affinity with the States, don't you?
Yes, I do. I think it's I know people probably going to, you know, have hate messages after this, but I do like America a lot. And I know the current political system is not the most loved, but, you know, to be honest, I belong to the car world of that country and the industry. I was very fortunate to get involved with SEMA and its principals back in 2006. So it's been almost a good 16 years and counting, where I've helped also develop the Middle East side of it. Because in 2006, they came up, SEMA came up with a program called Sell to the Middle East. So in short, the aftermarket world really took seriously, took this region seriously, and they wanted to really come out in all glory and sell product. And I think we have seen the huge growth in the GCC over the last 10 to 12 years because of that. But my love for the US is purely because, again, my childhood. I grew up watching TV. You know, we watched Fall Guy, Smokey and the Bandit, Kojak, Beretta, Chips, Starsky and Hutch, to name a few. Yeah. So guess what? You get brainwashed as a kid to love that.
Yeah.
And you live that. And so that's the reason why my car collection at the time was also reflecting the same. You know, I'm still into pickup trucks. Pickup trucks is one thing that I totally believe in. My parents used to call me a reincarnated Red Indian kid from Dallas, because all I did
You should have a Native American name, surely, right?
Well, I don't have a Native American name, but I do wear the chief.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. I follow Native American art and religion and the whole culture quite strongly.
Amazing. And just going back to the whole SEMA thing, were you still at, you weren't still at GM at the time, were you? How did you come about doing the SEMA stuff?
Okay, so I was at Liberty Motorsport, which is the motorsport leg of Liberty Automobiles. And I went to work there in 2006. So while we were at it, that was that one year when GM went big and during a Dubai Motor Show, and they brought in two Chevy Cruze highly modified cars. One was done by Dub Magazine, and the other one was done by the famous West Coast Customs.
Oh, cool.
Unfortunately, both cars arrived here on freight, and they had issues on the rear wheels. For some reason, they were locked and they couldn't get it out. Mm-hmm. So GM made a call to me. And that's kind of how I went and met the SEMA principals.
Yeah.
And we sorted all that out. And from there on, it was history. We had a sort of a fall in love situation between myself and those people. And I imagine a very
strong affinity there. I imagine you would have had with the whole SEMA thing. And you've attended SEMA yourself several times, haven't you?
I've done it for the last 17 years in a row.
Wow.
I also visit in between. They have several workshops.
Yeah.
So they have exhibitor conferences where they bring in people from all over the world to be spokesmen for, you know, how to do it right, how to get it right kind of thing. SEMA is, a lot of people refer to it as a big car show, and that it is. It is the biggest car show on the planet. However, SEMA is also an educational institute. So it sets legislation, it draws out certain programs. It does a lot more than what people think it does.
So do you think in the current climate where we're seeing a lot of motor shows fail, a lot of traditional motor shows are failing, for example, Geneva is now pretty much dead, and I think other shows are going to follow suit. Do you think SEMA is okay? Because SEMA has a very different personality and style to it, doesn't it?
It does have a certain personality and style. And then again, we're talking, if SEMA was in Australia or UK or mainland Europe, it probably would die as well. But it's in the USA. And, I was just talking to a few colleagues, and it's all systems go, even for November this year. We just, when I say we, one of the organizations I work for during the Riyadh car show, they just pulled off one of the largest off-road four-wheel jamborees in I think I would like to say Pasadena or something like that, or Philadelphia, but I mean geographically I'm not really up, you know, on the ball there.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
They you know, in spite of what's happening around the world right now, they had a huge attendance, and they pulled it off. And, you know, so that was the very first off-road car show post-COVID.
Yeah, well,
we
say post-COVID, but we're not quite out of the woods yet.
During COVID.
So, and the other thing I want to touch on, and of course, something that actually you helped us out as well a lot at Motoring Middle East, because we sort of kick-started the, let's call it the car meat culture, the cars and coffee type of culture, you know. But you're really a core part of car culture in the UAE, and you have been for a long time, right?
Yes, I have. And I like to help people. And that's really my goal, because I think there are a lot of youngsters who are starting up, and, you know, cars and people will always share that wonderful relationship, whether we drive electric cars in the future or we fly cars.
Don't you think that's one of the, because we spoke, who did I speak about this before to somebody? It was actually a recent conversation with Johnny Lieberman, actually. One of the videos that I've done here, check it out, those people mm-hmm. are watching. And we were talking about cars being the great unifier. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that I found in certainly in the UAE, where you would have people from all cultures, all backgrounds coming together with all kinds of different cars, particularly at our meets that we did at Motoring Middle East, and just getting on, because it was just so much fun, you know.
Well, I mean, it's almost as strong as music. If you remember the biggest car show you've done, basically it's you and MT and friends at Festival City.
Yeah.
I mean, we had no idea we would have 1,000 plus cars just show up. I still remember you running around saying, holy cow, the police is here. They had to shut down three traffic lights because they've turned into parking lots.
I said to somebody, I said, thankfully the police in Dubai are mostly car guys. And so they actually mucked in and helped rather than haul us away, which I always love them for, because, and they are, because some of my friends there were actually police guys, you know, so it was amazing.
Oh yeah. I have a lot of very close friends in the authorities, and they are diehard car guys. They some of them race on weekends. Some of them even have workshops in their farms where they build and swap engines, and so they're very much into it. I think for me, the best way I can sum it up is, back in the day, if you were a Bedouin or a nomad, you know, and if you had the fastest horse, you're the man. Today it's the car.
Yeah,
you know, it's the wheels. So it's a status symbol. It's I always believe in the expression, you are what you drive.
Yeah.
And it can be a Rolls Royce Wraith, or it can be a Honda Civic. It all depends on who you are and what your image is and what you want to portray as your personality. I think that's really important. And for a lot of the GCC nationals, I think that's really, really how it is. Everybody wants to make a statement.
No, I think you're quite right. Talking of statements, because you're so into a combination of off-roading and American cars and all the rest of it, I've got to ask you, what do you think of that new Bronco that's just been released?
Well, I'm going to take a big gulp and probably I'm going to take a drink of my lemonade. Personally, I don't like it.
Oh, wow. This is controversial right here.
Yeah, I totally dig the technology. Huge respect for Ford Motor Company. Although I'm not a Ford guy, I'm a big GM guy.
I know that. That's why I thought I'd ask you, because that.
Yeah. Wait. Just to leapfrog a little bit, wait till we see what the 1,000 horsepower Hummer is going to look like.
Okay.
And then we'll talk again on this this topic. But coming back to the Bronco, it's very interesting that they came up with three different models at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think it was kind of a great move, because you then have you appeal to literally, you know, three different demographics.
Yeah.
You know, Ford basically has been spearheading everything they do. You know, it's always the Mustang comes first, yeah, then comes the Camaro, then comes the Challenger, you know.
Yeah.
In the truck world, it's very similar.
It's a tip for tat sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, to this day, it's, you know, let's see what FCA comes up with. I'm sure they'll come up with a solid
Well, they've already teased a V8 Wrangler, haven't they? I think just to preempt the Bronco, the day before
they
teased the
V8.
Well,
it's not a tease, it's for real. I actually spoke to a few people from the FCA barn in Turin yesterday. And they confirmed to me that is very real. Uh-huh. They also confirmed to me that there is a crazy Wagoneer coming.
Yes, that's right. Yes, indeed.
And they also confirmed to me that there's a brand spanking new Grand Cherokee coming. So, you know, Jeep has always been, you know, very, very strong in that arena.
So I tell you what, I think there's going to be a bit of a renaissance then for four-wheel drives. I think we're entering into a new era, you know, because we've still got the Wrangler, we've got the G-Wagon, we've got a new Defender, we've got the Bronco, and we've got stuff coming from the Hummer, the reborn Hummer, and the Wagoneers and stuff. This is amazing. We're going to have
Only the reborn Hummer, but there's also going to be a something in between between an Acadia and a Blazer, kind of, you know, crossover SUV type thing on steroids. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting. Had the COVID not happened, we would have already seen pre-prods and prototypes already out running now.
Yeah.
I think everything was put on hold for almost a year now. So
What is
more interesting, Shahzad, is what's coming from the EV world.
I was going to get to that. I was going to say, hang on, because I was going to just wrap that up with the Japanese need to get their act together, because I think they're falling behind a little bit, especially with the end of the FJ Cruiser. Now, coming to that, so you've done events, you've done modification, you've done custom cars, you've done V8s, you've done tourism. What's left? Yeah, I was going to ask you what's left, and you've preempted that by saying EVs. Now, this is a bit of a shock to me, because knowing you as I do for the last, you know, more than a decade,
the thing is,
and EVs?
All right, it's chalk and cheese. I know, but here's what it is. I've always believed that you've got to go with the flow. You can't be one of those old, you know, nagging chaps in the corner that says, you know, back in the day we had this and everything was cool. I try to stay within the trends and ongoing stuff. I have to confess that I'm a bit of a tech and a gadget freak. So that kind of helps with the whole EV thing, because anything on the EV world is, you know, it's fully loaded with touch screens and infotainment systems, and then comes all this new jargon of artificial intelligence,
which
I have a huge interest for.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things we just really have to embrace, because you can't avoid it, or you can't say no. And really, the most simplest way I can think of it, and we use this at work a lot, is you know, we had the dumb phone in the early days, and now we have a smartphone. So we had the dumb car, and now we are venturing into the smart car. So, you know, it is what it is.
Interesting.
In the old days, we used to slap gears and looked at each other over the shoulder and race like crazy. Today, we may be able to do the same thing, but while talking to each other while the car is doing that for us.
Yeah, exactly. So what's next for you? Are you getting into that? Is that where you're heading now? Is that what you're doing professionally?
I'm part of a startup venture right now. We haven't really taken off the ground yet, but we have some very interesting product, and hopefully once this whole pandemic time is over and we are up and running, hopefully on our next chat I can tell you more about some of the amazing brands and their functions and features and things like that. So that's really one of my headings. While I do that and wait for that to kick in, I still do my adventure drives, I still do my consultation work, I still do anything to help people. But here's something I can tell you. I have another Torquay in the build.
All right. Okay. We'll have to put a picture up to explain to people what you mean by that. Yeah.
Yes. So here it is. I have a very dear friend, and again, somebody higher up in the Dubai police, who saw the picture and went absolutely nuts and says, I want exactly the same thing done. So I said to him, I'll tell you what, I'll build you something better. So because that was my learning curve, and now I know how to, finish those teething issues that I had while I was building that. So there's some cool projects that I'm working on right now, including a kind of a semi-soft YouTube channel that I'm actually going to also launch.
Cool.
This is just for fun.
So I'll tell you what.
It has nothing to do with off-roading.
Well, tell people where they can find you. So if anybody wanting to get in, because the thing is, like, I always say I'm going to do these for 30 minutes. I always go well over. But anyway, we're running out the clock now. So quickly tell people where they can find you if they want to get in touch with you.
Well, people can actually get in touch with me at desertrides@gmail.com. That's my email address. The new program is going to be called Mitch's Trail Bites and Friends. It's all about cooking, but on trails and
excellent
tracks. Yeah,
excellent.
And you'll see some famous faces and suspects on that. Some of the people that have come on your buddy
all
programs.
Right. Cool.
I think we have a lot of mutual friends. So
we do. Yes, definitely. Yes. That'll be fun.
Thank you very much for your time. I mean, it's great talking to you.
Oh, no, dude, thank you so much. It's so good to catch up with all the great people that I got to know over the years.
I wish I could talk to you a lot about the tourism side of it, because I spent almost 25 years doing that in both for SNTTA Tours as well as Arabian Adventures.
I think we'll have to catch up again soon on the next episode, and then we can talk about more of this stuff. But to wrap up, thanks so much for doing this, Mitch. I wish you all the best. I hope you get through this COVID situation very quickly and start those projects. I can't wait to see that YouTube channel and that new project that you're working on. Once again, thanks so much for joining, and see you again soon.
See you, Shazab. You have a good day.
Oh, I think he's betraying the cause there, I think, going down that whole EV thing, but it's inevitable, isn't it? So a lot of fascinating stuff that we covered in that, and a lot of interesting stuff that's happened during this guy's career, and a lot more to come, I'm sure. So stay tuned, follow him on his channels, follow me on my channels. Like I said, make sure that you follow, you are subscribing to this channel, which is youtube.com/browncarguy. Follow me on #browncarguy, that's on all social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and of course subscribe to browncarguy.com. If you enjoy these videos and you can support me, then please head over to patreon.com/ShazadSheikh, and there you'll be able to support me, and you'll also find some goodies and some exclusive content just for you. Let me know what you think of it. Even if you can't, please continue to like, comment, share, subscribe, and all the rest of it, because that really helps as well. Thank you so much for watching, and I'll catch you again soon in the next one.